Today's podcast is brought to you by Audible.com. Get a free audiobook download at www.audibletrial.com/thedrilldown. Over 100,000 titles to choose from for your iPod and MP3 player. Hello and welcome to The Drill Down, the podcast where we take a look at some of the week's most important events in tech and on the web and how they affect us all. I'm Andy Cercini.
I'm Dwayne DeFreitas.
And I'm Tosin Anofowakin.
This week, Google buys a quantum computer, Yahoo buys Instant Cool with Tumblr and spruces up tired old Flickr, and Microsoft launches the next generation of Xbox. As always, you can check out past episodes of The Drill Down, as well as the other fine shows in the Geeks of Doom podcast network on geeksofdoom.com. Subscribe to us on iTunes. Go to facebook.com/thedrilldown and twitter.com/thedrilldown to connect with us. First, we occasionally like to do a segment on the show we call What We're Playing With, where we talk about the gadgets, apps, and tech that has obsessed us over the last week. And there's a couple of things I want to talk about. First of all, last week, when in the wake of Google's I/O conference, Google unveiled their conversational search, which is like the desktop version of Google Glass, where instead of putting on Google Glass and saying, "Okay, Glass," and being able to deliver commands to Google Glass, you can say, "Okay, Google," and start delivering search commands to Google.com. And currently, it has gone live on Chrome only. And I tried this out today, and it works fairly well. And it's actually a little spooky. it's exactly
what I wanted out of Siri, is what it is.
Yeah, yeah. Have you tried it on Chrome?
I have used it. I like it very much. I am impressed. I think it really depends on the resolution of your microphone,
yeah,
on your laptop or your desktop, whatever you're using. But I used it today, and my coworkers were like, "What are you doing?" Like, sort of like in the beginning of when people had a Bluetooth headsets and you seemed like you were talking to yourself the whole time. That's kind of what I saw. But yeah, I really enjoyed it. I thought it was really well done, and I don't know if I'll be using it a lot when I'm not at home by myself, as I learned today, but I think it's definitely worth checking out.
Yeah, for sure. I mean, it's still the voice recognition still does terribly at proper names. I tried searching for each of our names independently using it, and it couldn't recognize what I was saying for. But I think that's not the fault of the search itself. I think it's just the fault of proper names and voice recognition software. So, but other than that, for other things, it worked really well. It was able to tell me the volume of the Grand Canyon just by, you know, delivering the command and other things. It gave me a nice image, a search for Kate Upton. So there you go. It all worked
out. I
can't
believe you looked for Kate Upton.
You know what? It did recognize that name for sure.
Well, yeah, because it's like the name is all just like really simple sounds. It's not like Dwayne DeFreitas. Like it's, yeah. It's Kate Upton.
Yeah. Tosin Anofowakin, forget it. It just failed miserably.
It's hard to say, but if you're looking at it from the scheme where Google has all this knowledge surrounding it. So, for example, when this is when we were testing out Google Glass and I was on Google's campus, and my friend added me to his as like a favorite in his contacts. And of course, it has my proper name. So he had to utilize it at least with Glass to dial or text me, and it recognized me. And so I think given that our devices get smart enough to not only utilize the information online, but utilize common information about the individual who is giving the commands, and it should be able to create smart prompts and awareness. There should be that sort of awareness.
It should get. I mean, like, how many times is Tosin? Google has an audio search, and that audio search allows you to look for podcasts and stuff.
Mm-hmm.
By this time, they should have heard the term Tosin Onufuwakan a whole bunch. Now, I know that's a stretch. You know, their computers aren't reading everything all the time, but that's the expectation we've been led to believe. If they're scrounging around the web to get the most information, they should be listening to the audio and using these amazing voice recognition techniques to listen to podcasts and figure out and like recognize patterns. Tosin Onufuwakan, Dwayne DeFreitas, Devinger Hardwar.
Sure.
These are not the easiest names, sure.
No.
Right? But at the same time, this is America. You know, this is where the language is moving in this country.
You know what I expect from Google, and I imagine, as creepy as this sounds, I feel two ways about this. On the one hand, it's a little creepy, but this is the most efficient way to do this, is for me to sign in to Chrome, and then have when I deliver voice commands on Google, it goes through my contacts and sees if any of the proper names if anything that I'm saying to it matches something in my contact list, then
that might work. But even now, my girlfriend's name is pretty normal, and I'll say her name and the computer won't get it. I have to have given her I gave her a nickname that I have to call out. That's with Siri, fine. But I mean, I feel like that's the way it would have to work. You'd have to give people basically, at this point, at this stage in the game with voice recognition, you'd have to give the computer a kind of shortcut. You know? Like, I would just say Andrew Sorsini. I wouldn't say that. I'd be like, blarg. And it would know that's Andrew Sorsini. You know?
Right.
Someone's really
right,
pronounceable.
Right. And the other thing that we all got a chance to see, and we mentioned last week's show that we're going to talk about this, is Star Trek Into Darkness, the latest movie in the J.J. Abrams Star Trek reboot.
A.K.A. Star Trek 12.
Yes, if you're still counting from the first movie. Now,
think about it this way.
Yeah.
1991, let me just say one thing. 1991 was when Star Trek VI, The Undiscovered Country, came out. That was the last officially numbered Star Trek film.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
And that was the last film with the original cast of Star Trek, like, from the original series. That was 22 years ago.
Wow.
And now we're at 10 movie. We're at 12 movies later, right? I mean, 6 movies later.
Sure.
So it's we're half again out from the original cast. That's how longstanding this bit of content, this universe, has survived in relevant, popular culture. Like, it's continually, continually produced culture.
Not even to mention the television series before it.
Well, the television series, it was 3 years, and then there was a lot of talk and a lot of hullabaloo until the movie came out in 79, whatever. But the big deal was that for 17 straight years, there was a Star Trek series, or in some cases, two series, being produced. So this is like, you know, this is a big deal.
Sure.
You know, I mean, the fact that America's kept this notion, the fact that Google, one of America's flagship technology companies, thinks about Star Trek and what it does, you know, this is a cultural piece of who we are.
Absolutely.
That's exciting, which is why I think it was important that we all take a look at it as geeks.
Really one of the most influential television series ever produced, if you think about it.
Yeah.
So what we're gonna do right now is we're gonna talk in general terms without spoilers about our impressions of the movie, and then at the end of the podcast, after we sign off, we'll get into some spoiler talk about Star Trek Into Darkness. So let me ask you guys. Let me start with you, Dwayne. What did you think about? First of all, before we do that, what was your impression of the first J.J. Abrams movie? What's your relationship to Star Trek in general, and then how did you feel about this latest Star Trek movie?
I'll start with my relationship to Star Trek. I'm a fan. My girlfriend and I calculated all the time it takes to watch Star Trek, given that I've seen every single episode and every single movie, including the animated series, and it's like 3 weeks of your life without eating or sleeping, and I've gone through that, and I mostly went through that in the early 2000s. I got access to like DVDs, and I'd watch them before going to bed. I mean, I obviously watched Star Trek when I could catch it growing up, yeah. But I had school, so I really couldn't just like watch every episode. But when I was about, I guess, 20, I started just rewatching them. I did my own rewatch, and I did them all in order. And it was fantastic. So I'm a big fan. I did not particularly enjoy Enterprise. But when it comes to the series and all the other stuff pre-Abrams, I really enjoyed it. When it comes to Abrams, I felt that the first Star Trek movie he made, you know, 4 years ago, was a reasonable science fiction action movie. It was not a great Star Trek movie. It was in line with the other odd-numbered Star Trek movies.
Interesting.
Star Trek speaks. You said it was influential. It speaks to society. It's science fiction. It's not about laser guns and spaceships,
right?
In the way that Star Wars can.
It's about interpersonal relationships and the things that affect human beings
and personal perseverance. For me, you know, like you look at Picard, you look at Riker, you look at all these people, you look at you know, Spock. These people worked really hard to get where they are, and the very first thing that Abrams does is say, "Hey, I'm Captain Pike. Hey, you look cool. You want to join my ship, Kirk?" And he's like, "I'm sick. You want to be the captain of my ship, Kirk? Okay, cool. Everyone, he's the new captain. I'm going to go home and be an admiral." Like, that was my experience watching the first movie. Huh. Wait, what? Like, there was no... Like, with Star Wars, some things happen because the adventures are happening, and there's not a lot of... there's not a lot of, like uniform and pomp and circumstance. But Star Trek is the opposite. It's like... We have figured it all out. This is how you get from here to here. Screw money. It's all about who you are as an individual and what you can do to like achieve. And that clearly wasn't there. Like Kirk's like, "Hey, you look cool. What's your name?" "Scotty." "Oh yeah, be the chief engineer." "I don't know who the chief engineer is now, but you're gonna be it." That's not how things work. Like, so that really threw me off. And then the destruction of the previous universe to start this one was something I found completely unnecessary. They should have comic booked it and just started. Just been like, "This is Star Trek."
And what did you think about Star Trek Into Darkness?
I was pleased. It was very predictable, but very wonderful at the same time. Like, I knew it was going to happen pretty much throughout the entire film, without having read about it or anything, just because I recognized these plot lines. And yet I was thoroughly entertained. I thought, you know, Benedict Cumberbatch for me is, you know, he's obviously a very good actor. I often see him as, you know, I cross my fingers every day and hope that he becomes a 12th Doctor. But other than that, I think he fits
well,
the bill.
Well, he's got a good inline. He's got a good inroad to that. If they ever want to make that happen, for sure, he knows people who can get that done.
Yeah, and he's worked with some of them on Sherlock.
Sure,
Moffat.
Tosin, how about yourself? What did you think? What's your relationship to the Star Trek universe? What did you think about the first Abrams reboot, and then what did you think about this movie?
So my relationship to the Star Trek universe is very brief. I've seen, you know, the previous Star Trek movie from Abrams, as well as a few of the other smattering smattering movies, not all of them, and not really consistent. But other than that, you know, a few months ago, I'd never really seen an episode of Star Trek. I'd only seen bits and pieces here and there. Now, because that's the case, a lot of my fellow podcasters put together a bucket list of Star Trek for me.
Oh,
actually.
Nice.
So a list of 177 episodes.
Wow.
Across all of Star Trek.
And that's not a lot, considering there are something like 700 episodes of Star Trek.
Exactly.
Yeah.
And I'll share the list with you guys.
I'd love to see that.
But I've watched a little bit of it, and I'm actually kind of glad that I watched some of those episodes prior to seeing this movie. It helped create some deeper ties that made it a little bit more enjoyable. But in terms of this current Star Trek Into Darkness, I really enjoyed it. I thought it was a fun film. I think the pacing was incredible. J.J. Abrams really knows how to pace a film so that it doesn't have very many moments, if any at all, where you're, you know, looking at your watch to see how much time is left.
Mm-hmm.
He knows when to cut things and when to end things. And yeah, this was in the prior week I'd seen Iron Man, and I just thought this this topped Iron Man because it actually had a somewhat consistent plot.
Oh my god! All right, we're just
but in terms of like consistency and huge sort of like plot holes and I'm not sure what the I can't recall what the word is, but basically just putting things in certain places that
like foreshadowing.
Not
foundation. Really. Foundation.
Exposition.
There were things there that allowed you to like make the logical leaps and maintain your suspense of disbelief, even if amazing things happen.
To a certain extent, but also to a certain extent, like the enemy and the victim. Without saying too much about Iron Man, but some of the enemies in Iron Man were only as strong as they needed to be in the situation.
Right.
And so that really kind of threw me off, and as well as part of the ending was just not as strong. Iron Man was a lot of fun, but this was, I think Star Trek Into Darkness was both fun, but also both really had that foundational depth that pulled everything together. It felt like it was more tightly woven.
Yeah, the foundation is important, and I think with Iron Man, far less people are familiar with Iron Man as a comic book than they are with Iron Man as a picture. And with Star Trek, it's the exact opposite, right? Like, it's so storied, as we discussed. So if you've been following the comic book, the third Iron Man movie comes almost directly from a series of episodes in the comic book that you know, tie you to. Much like how Batman, for many of us, there was a TV show that really brought it back. There was the Dark Knight series and all other things like that. I feel like that really would have helped Iron Man, but Iron Man was just never been a popular comic on the same level that Batman ever was, and Star Trek obviously outshadows them both almost. So yeah, I can see why the foundation wasn't there for you. Although I would say with the Abrams, the new Star Trek movie, there's a scene that completely mimics Star Wars, and I was like, wait, what? Are we on Coruscant? That threw me off.
Well, you know, it's been one of the criticisms of Abrams' reboot of Star Trek is that he's really sort of wish fulfilling. He's fulfilling his wish to direct Star Wars, which he's going to do that. Yes, but both of these movies were filmed before that announcement came to pass, before he could get the chance to, but now he's going to be able to. Now, like, my personal thoughts about this film, first of all, I'm a huge Star Trek fan, but I wouldn't say that I geek out about Star Trek. I'm very sort of grounded in my love for Star Trek. Watched the original series growing up with my dad in reruns, and followed virtually every other incarnation on TV. There are some that I passed on, like Deep Space Nine. I never was a big fan.
Oh, it's so good.
And the movies I've followed as well, and the movies have been hit and miss. I would say that of all of the movies, that there's a solid, like, you know, there's like maybe two or three that are the cream of the crop of the entire series of movies up until the Abrams reboot, which I consider a different sort of entity. Because it is sort of fundamentally different. It's canon, but it's a different canon. It's an alternate canon, I feel. But I think it's also the kind of move that the franchise needed to get out of kind of the dusty old stale. It needed a little bit of shaking up. And I'm already a big fan of Abrams' work and the way he's I feel like Abrams is really the first generation that has grown up with the works of Lucas and Spielberg, and he's the first generation that has been influenced directly by the work of blockbuster directors like George Lucas and Steven Spielberg, and we're now seeing that generation grow up and make movies of their own, and Star Trek is amongst them. So it's clearly directly influenced by those directors, by Spielberg and Lucas.
Wouldn't you say that Michael Bay has also grown up with that influence?
Yeah, but he's
done that for a long time.
Sure, I'm not
a fan of Abrams, so I can't jump on the bandwagon with you. But I just feel like he's not the only one who grew up with Spielberg.
There are other directors who I feel like are a stronger influence for a director like Michael Bay, like Hal Needham, the guy who did the Smokey and the Bandit movies. I feel is a stronger influence for him. But as far as the Star Trek reboot goes, I was a huge fan. I feel I'm not so attached to Star Trek that I didn't feel betrayed by the reboot and all the changes in the reboot. I'm a big fan of Abrams to begin with, so I got into the groove of what he was trying to do. And I felt for this movie, Into Darkness, I thought it was equally as strong. I would say that this movie is as good, if not better, than Abrams' first Star Trek film. It does have its flaws. There's a lot of sort of plot holes and certain plot elements that are a little too convenient to make certain elements of the plot happen. They're kind of placed in there, and you know what's going to happen because it's a little too convenient. And it doesn't take... we'll get into this in the spoilers, but there are some risks that earlier movies, Star Trek movies, have been able to take that this one kind of promised that it would take, and then it doesn't quite take those risks. So I feel it was a little copped out a little bit on that. But overall, a really strong film, and I really enjoyed Benedict Cumberbatch's role as the villain, and I think he just basically this is his breakout film role. Personally, I think you know, he's already proven himself on Sherlock, but this is the movie that is going to make a name for himself for other roles moving forward in film.
This is also, like, I would say that Star Trek in movie number 10 and movie number 12, so this movie and Nemesis, they've chosen these British actors, Tom Hardy and now Benedict Cumberbatch, to portray a new, different type of evil. In fact, Star Trek 7 had had another British actor as their evil as the evil bad guy, and it wasn't so much crazy evil as it is cerebral evil.
Sure.
Doing the wrong thing for the right reasons. And I think Star Trek is always, and this is why this movie is so much more attractive to me. When the Romulans attacked in the last film, it was like, okay, they're just Romulans. In this film, in Star Trek 10 Nemesis, in Star Trek 7 Generations, you know, Roddy McDowell is the guy in that one. These people are bad. But the question remains on whether or not they're evil. They're doing all the wrong things for possibly the right reasons. Or, you know, and that's what makes this a far better movie than the 2009 film, where the conflict was completely unclear. The people who were, the motivations of the characters were also sort of like, oh. And then other little silly things like women with tails or green women in the beds and all that shit. This doesn't need to exist. I felt that this movie was better because it had a series of villains, really, that made it far more about who we are and how we deal with these kinds of problems.
Right. How we deal with, essentially, it's about how we deal with a terrorist threat of which there is no sort of rational. We can't deal with them on a rational level because they don't use rational terms in their conflict.
Right, and then you think about what's motivating, you know, Benedict Cumberbatch. He's motivated by the fact that he needs you know, it's society's fault that he is where he is.
Right.
In some respects. Right. He didn't just happen, you know. He was made very, very literally. So it's great. I think it was a good movie. My girlfriend was sitting with me when we watched it, and she was able to enjoy the fact that she could mouth certain words from having seen. It's just that it's they did a very good. I mean, like, I think it's clear that Abrams got a talking to. It's clear that he looked at what he had done before in 2009, and that wasn't enough to put the name Star Trek on it in 2013. He had to tie it back.
Yeah.
He had to stop running away from what's made the franchise this powerful.
Yeah.
And he was able to do that very effectively. And I think that's the thing. People say, oh, I wasn't a big Star Trek fan. I don't really care. But then when he does a movie like this, you begin to see why it matters that this is a Star Trek movie.
Yeah.
It has to have Star Trek pieces to it. And that's what it does.
All right, let's get into some of the discussion of our headlines this week. Google and a corporation associated with NASA are forming a laboratory to study artificial intelligence by means of computers that use unusual properties of quantum physics. Their quantum computer, which performs complex calculations thousands of times faster than existing supercomputers, is expected to be in active use in the third quarter of this year. The Quantum Artificial Intelligence Lab, as the entity is called, will focus on machine learning, which is the way computers take note of patterns of information to improve their outputs. Personalized internet search and predictions of traffic congestion based on GPS data are examples of machine learning. The field is particularly important for things like facial or voice recognition, biological behavior, or the management of very large and complex systems. The most effective methods for using quantum computation, Google said, involved combining the advanced machines with its clouds of traditional computers. So Google's going to be using these quantum computers in combination with their own vast cloud of data set to do...
But I mean, that's the only way they could do it, right? They can scrap their current stuff just to use new stuff. You got to bridge it somehow.
Yeah. I think this is, you know, both... I think this is awesome for Google. I think this is going to really turbocharge their data parsing and what they're going to be able to do with it. And at the same time, as a Google user, I'm a little concerned once again about the whole data privacy issue and how this is going to affect that.
I don't know. All I see here is this, again, that tie-in with Star Trek. You know, they're using AI in order to get more efficient. Voyager used bioneural gel packs, isolinear chips in Next Generation. You know what I mean? Like, they're saying it's all about the back end. We're making a library computer of all this information. We need something that's going to deal with it a little bit better than what we've got. What's the next step? It's this. Quantum computing has been spoken about for 10 years now, if not longer.
Yeah.
So they have the resources to move that forward. It's not some huge governmental organization like the Federation. It's Google. And I'm just glad that they're able to, because if they can make this Google Now and Google Conversation Search or just work better, if I can more easily, if it can more easily understand Tosin Anafawak and Dwayne DeFreitas or, you know, Andrew Sassini, right. Then that's, it's like the thing with like the scanners in the airports. If that scanner made it so that I could keep my shoes on the whole time, sure, I don't care.
Yeah.
And the idea is if they can make it more convenient, then like, let's just do it. Who cares? I mean, obviously there's the whole, like, will the Cylons attack in 200 years because of this technology? Will Skynet attack us in 50 years because of this technology? Sure, why not? Hopefully they'll be dead. But in the meantime, just make it faster.
Yeah, and you know what? I think I'm a little... I think it's going to be a while because I think we're still just hitting the iceberg in terms of what quantum computing can do. And there's a very slim margin of things that quantum computing can do that is actually faster than conventional computing. But I think, you know, as the years progress, we're going to get a lot more out of it. I just don't think it's anything that's going to provide Google with an instantaneous plethora of
data crunching. Yeah,
right. Just not yet.
Because I mean, yeah, it's like when the transistors first gave way to microprocessors. Microprocessors were a big deal, but they weren't that big. It was only a few years later that we were able to see, wow, there you go. So I don't know. I just feel like I was born too early. I just wanted it to be faster.
Well, maybe in turn, this could boost development in quantum computing. So could be. We could have a...
it most certainly will. I don't know if we'll see desktops or like laptops with quantum-based chips inside them in the near future, but you never know.
All right, moving on here. We talked last episode after Google I.O. about how there was virtually no mention about Google Glass in the keynote. And Google Glass, and since then, actually like a day or two after that I.O. conference, Google announced that they would have 7 new apps for Google Glass, including breaking news alerts from CNN, fashion features from Elle, Twitter, Tumblr, and Facebook posts and reminder notes from Everywhere. It's calling the bundle of apps Glassware, and they announced that on last Thursday at their I.O. conference, in front of the largest assembly yet of people wearing glass in the same place. They joined Path and New York Times as the only apps so far available on Glass. The glasses also offer Google services like search and maps, connect to user's cell phone, text messaging, etc. So this is just, I think this is just an example of how they're kickstarting these new features, and it's just going to get more populated. These apps are going to get more populated from here on out. And I think it's just a matter of, you know, Glass is not ready for prime time, but we can see that now that development is actually happening. People are starting to work on it. Apps are starting to be released for it. So it's all a matter of time before it's ready for prime time.
Yeah, I mean, I think Google is definitely pushing on more people to develop for Glass. I know several other organizations that, you know, Google has reached out to saying, hey, I think one of the ploys is being the first on the device. As well as, if you really think about it, the people who have the device right now are typically, I would say typically more wealthier individuals in general. And, organizations who are curious about development and curious what it has to offer. And if you can get your app, say you're a startup or, you know, some small organization, if you can get your app in front of their eyes, you know, that gives you a little bit, that might help you in the long run for your organization. So I think they're really trying to push significantly harder on that, as well as by having more developers, they can refine Glass itself as well as refine the APIs behind that.
Moving on here, I found that this article was interesting as it relates to some of the other gaming news that we're going to be talking about a little bit later. And this comes from Kotaku. Less than 2 years after vowing to deliver on a, quote, unprecedented partnership with Nintendo, gaming giant EA is quiet on the Wii U front. We have no games in development for the Wii U currently, company spokesperson Jeff Brown told Kotaku. He did not rule out the chances of EA developing for the Wii U again, but the company struggled to find a blockbuster hit for the Wii, and the full absence of Wii U games from Nintendo's pipeline seem increasingly likely as the Wii U remained conspicuously absent from announcements regarding major 2013 EA games such as Battlefield 4 and the new Madden and FIFA. A lack of EA support will prevent Wii U gamers from having access to an NFL game for which EA holds the exclusive license. So, I mean, this again is just another, I think it's another nail in the coffin for Nintendo in general as a console company. Don't you think?
Yeah. On one hand, I want to say, well, you never know, but I guess what I'm actually really curious about is usually when you have these partnerships, there's some sort of promise. And some sort of, you know, signed note that's saying, hey, we will develop or we will produce certain apps. So it's really intriguing that it looks like maybe none of that was in place at the time that the announcement made. Or maybe things have just changed since it's a different CEO at this juncture. But EA usually just tries to get their games on all devices for everyone, but I think they're really noticing that their market share are users who will have either a new PlayStation or a new Xbox rather than a Wii. And if they do have a Wii, it's probably like the secondary console in their a Wii U. It's probably a secondary console in their living space. So
yeah, is the juice worth the squeeze to develop for such a unique device whose gameplay is so incredibly different and whose experience is very much not their core demographics experience or interest level. So I'd be like, I can see a company like Leapfrog jumping up and saying, hey, Nintendo, we're going to make some games for you. I don't know that these gaming companies that have created immersive cinematic experiences want to spend the incredible amounts of developer time to port a game over to the Wii U, which is a console that frankly came out way too early for its time and was somewhat underdeveloped and is very reminiscent of the Dreamcast.
And you have to remember that EA has also been putting back cuts around their organization. So they laid off quite a lot of people.
They have a significant amount of developers,
Yep, they're having issues with their stock and other finances, and so this is the one of the easiest areas to cut back at.
Sure. A console that isn't known for its strong, sports support in the first place.
Yeah, we're just like adult immersive support. We're not known for that. Nintendo, unlike Microsoft and Sony, has taken a Disney perspective to the gaming vertical. They've said, we're really going to focus on the younger people, and that's where we're going to stay our focus. You can grow out of us. That's what they've said. We'll harken you back to Link. We'll harken you back to Mario, but really, the maturity isn't going to grow with you. Whereas when the first Xbox showed up, when the first PlayStation showed up, you know, PlayStation hit a lot of us, you know, in the mid-90s. We're like, wow, this is like it's a cool situation, like Sega's situation. And it was meant to garner attention from people who were interested in being sophisticated about the gaming situation. And they've only grown that sophistication over time to the point where they can develop these systems that cost $500-$600, going down to $300 after 7 years, knowing that adults will buy these systems because adults know that the content has grown with them. We are the beginning of, I mean, Andy and me especially are the beginning of the whole gaming generation. And the fact that those two companies have decided to focus on making games that have grown with us instead of just saying, okay, you're 30, you're done. Everything we're making is people under 30, is exactly the opposite of the Nintendo and Disney outlook. And I think that has not served them well in terms of the way that people look at them in terms of where they're going to spend their dollars.
Yeah, I agree. I feel like they've really dropped the ball this product cycle, and they've been super short-sighted when it comes to, you know, the big picture of where their audience is or who their audience could be.
Yeah, especially because they could have had it all. If they had the Wii U and they had the graphics to back it up, there would have been some truly innovative games. Even now, the PlayStation 3 with the PlayStation Move technology doesn't touch the Wii's fun and functionality. It's just that when you want an immersive game experience, you can't turn to the Wii. So you go back to conventional controllers and these two big boys in the space.
All right, moving on here. We've talked about Aereo before, which is the online TV service that uses little plastic antennas that you attach to your mobile devices. They rent you out the antenna, and you can, using those antenna, you can get live and time shifted television over the internet, or basically over airwaves. You can get TV broadcast over airwaves. Well, that startup announced last week that it'll soon be available in the Atlanta metropolitan area, which will make it accessible to more than 5.3 million consumers in 55 counties across Georgia, Alabama, and North Carolina. And last year, the media giants collectively sued Aereo, claiming that the online TV technology violates their copyrights. And the companies argued that their transmission of TV broadcast to computers and mobile devices constitutes, quote, live performance, which is subject to licensing fees. CBS chief Les Moonves and News Corp chief Rupert Murdoch have been amongst Aereo's most vocal critics, threatening to turn their networks into cable channels if Aereo isn't shut down. While public airways are technically a free resource, the vast majority of the viewing public gets its television through cable companies, which must pay retransmission fees to broadcast networks. That broadcasters have been so aggressive in trying to prevent an Aereo craze from ever happening speaks volumes about its potential as a game changer. And yet big media's litigation-happy strategy reeks of the failed tactics employed by the music and movie industries, both of which tried to sue technological change into oblivion. And, this is an interesting case because, I think one of the reasons that Aereo has succeeded is because it's got some fairly big guns behind it. One of the CEOs is Barry Diller, who was the basically the creator of the Fox Networks, and the he also created the USA Networks as well. This guy is a very savvy guy. He knows how to play with the big boys in broadcast, and he knows exactly where to, what loopholes to skirt around. And technically they're in their rights. I mean, they are just using an antenna, a highly efficient antenna, to collect the signals that the broadcasters are already transmitting and are free to receive via antenna, right? I mean, there's fundamentally nothing wrong with what Aereo is doing. But I think it's the fact that they're doing it so efficiently in offering that, and then renting out the antenna use to people is, and the broadcasters not getting a cut of that rental fee is what's pissing off the broadcasters.
Yeah, they are challenging the foundations of a archaic beast, and these organizations are very adverse to change, so they're gonna be fighting this with tooth and nail. But I what I really look forward to, one day I can watch my local sports team in California, my local Massachusetts sports team in California, without having to subscribe to everyone else's sports team or get some ridiculous packages to do so. That is what I look forward to. Now, that may be a ways off, but this is a step in the right direction. I'm very glad that so far this movement hasn't been halted, because who knows? Maybe we'll see some change, and maybe we can really shake the foundations, as Jack Burton would say in Big Trouble.
Right. I have a feeling, and we've seen it before in both the movie and music industries, that when people want it bad enough, the establishment eventually changes. They bend to the will of how people want to receive their media, whether it be technologically bend to the will or lower their prices to make the media more accessible, more easier to purchase and more affordable. One way or the other, they bend to the will of the consumer. Also, along with this, Dwayne, you linked to me a article about Arrested Development.
Aereo is bringing traditional television onto your mobile device. It's essentially turning your mobile device into some level of a TV screen. That's why the antenna exists. So, analog to digital. This story came out of NPR, and Neda Ulubi reported it. And basically, she spoke about how Arrested Development is leading a charge for old brands to reinvent themselves in new media.
Uh-huh.
She detailed a whole bunch of shows that I think people that enjoy this own podcast.
Arrested Development, Radiohead,
Veronica Mars. The list goes on and on. Firefly,
Louis C.K.
Another one. Again, Arrested Development and Louis C.K. are not science fiction, but they do. They do lean on that sort of very niche, super quirky, somewhat doesn't fit in aspect of geek culture. that
Zach Braff with his Kickstarter. All of these people are disrupting.
And these people are people who were bridging. They're coming from old media.
Yeah.
In fact, they mentioned that this isn't always the easiest thing to do. Melissa Joan Hart, you know, of Sabrina the Teenage Witch fame, and along with you know, Clister Explains It All. She's definitely a part of the generation that would get involved in this. But her Kickstarter campaign did not come across as one that connected with the individual, that connected with us in a way that makes Twitter work. I remember when I got on Twitter, the first person I followed was LeVar Burton, because I was like, I can talk to Jordy now. And she did not – I mean, just tying it all back into Star Trek, I guess. And hers looked like it was made by a PR person's intern, I think the quote from the story was. So this idea is, I mean, we've talked about Veronica Mars, and we're all excited about Netflix holding on to Arrested Development and producing new episodes, which come out soon. But a thing that we haven't remembered is that so much of this comes from traditional or old media, broadcast media, you know, pre-cord cutting media. And what we've been able to do is get a cool idea of who's really interested, how interested they really are. They're going to raise money for Veronica Mars, that kind of thing on Kickstarter. And then that gives the studios the ability to bring them back or to want to purchase them. There's even talk that Microsoft might buy the rights to Heroes from NBC and make that an Xbox exclusive on the new Xbox One.
Right.
That's exciting. Not that I love the end of Heroes, but just that kind of thing is possible.
I'm just excited about the possibility. I'm not a big fan of seeing Heroes again.
Yeah, yeah. Heroes, definitely mixed reviews on Heroes, a.k.a. the ghetto X-Men. But right?
Like, I enjoyed the first season.
The first season was great. Yeah,
the first season was cool. And they're like, oh, they're too powerful. Let's rip off their powers and all this other, make them really ghetto. Let's make a House of M situation right now. You know, so that's really what happened there. But regardless, the idea that we love all this the fact that the stuff is coming back and it's all user generated, it needs to be understood that it's being buttressed off of old media. So we have to remember, we have to wonder whether or not new media can truly survive without, you know, the trappings and understanding or standing on the shoulders of the old stuff. Now, House of Cards and some of the new other Netflix stuff, that's brand new to Netflix. You know, Netflix is making it from scratch. They're using actors that we know. Or with Lilyhammer, I guess they didn't. And Lilyhammer didn't really blow up the way they thought it would. But they use the data, they use the actors, they use the old stuff for House of Cards. And that's an example of new stuff. But then again, House of Cards itself is a remake of old media.
I think it's a symbiotic relationship. I mean, the new old media wants to continue to be relevant. So, you know, they have to embrace what new media is doing and adapt that to their, you know, their established streams.
Right. They have to adapt the new technology to their stuff. And we've seen that a little bit with, you know, TV everywhere from Xfinity and Cablevision and stuff. But at the same time, they're attacking companies like Aereo, who's just simply turning your phone into a TV. Let's look at where people's eyeballs are. They're on this phone. Let's see if they can see the stuff that's already free anyhow. And they're attacking that. So then you get this sort of like new wave, oh my God, the networks suck. And then you have this revitalization of this old content. Have the networks themselves abandoned, right? Let's face it. The reason why Netflix picked up Arrested Development, which first aired its first episode 10 years ago, is because the network dropped it on its face. Yeah. And that happened again and again with Veronica Mars and all these other things that we see coming up. The networks don't want to pick this stuff up because it's not general audience enough. It's not that eighth grade humor. It's sometimes a little bit more cerebral, sometimes a little bit more quirky.
Yeah, unless they can prove that it's worth their while. And that's what
the technology is doing.
Yeah.
In some cases, Netflix capitalizes by saying, we're going to use new media tactics to distribute this stuff. But in other cases, Veronica Mars, we're going to use new media tactics to give CBS or Paramount or whomever owns the content an excuse or a reason to get it done again. So it's just it's interesting that there is this symbiosis. But you have to wonder, if old media truly is old, then we have to think a little bit about the idea that what are they really going to do in the new media world? Only Netflix has really shown us, and YouTube with some of its newly produced native to web shows, have really shown us that
that were able to, you know, start something from scratch and have it succeed instead of building on the past. So I just thought that was interesting, that the fact that, you know, we always think of these kinds of things as a coup and like changing the game and all that stuff. Yeah, and yeah, it does, but it can't do it on its own.
Not yet.
Not yet. There's still a bridge happening, and I think that's important to remember.
And the question is, will there always need to be a bridge?
Yeah. I mean, the thing about hybrids is that eventually you want a Tesla, right? So.
All right, let's take a moment to talk about our sponsor, Audible.com, the world's leading provider of digital spoken word entertainment on the internet. For the listeners of the Drill Down podcast, Audible is offering a free audiobook download with a free 30-day trial to give you a chance to check out their service. And the book I'd like to recommend this week is called How the Mind Works by Steven Pinker. In this delightful, acclaimed bestseller, one of the world's leading cognitive scientists tackles the workings of the human mind. What makes us rational, and why are we so often irrational? How do we see in three dimensions? What makes us happy, afraid, angry, disgusted, or sexually aroused? Why do we fall in love, and how do we grapple with the imponderables of morality, religion, and consciousness? How the Mind Works synthesizes the most satisfying explanations of our mental life from cognitive science, evolutionary biology, and other fields to explain what the mind is, how it evolved, and how it allows us to see, think, feel, laugh, interact, enjoy the arts, and contemplate the mysteries of life. And what better? I mean, that sounds like a just nice capsule review of a book that you'd want to read, especially if you have any interest in how things work. So How the Mind Works, or any of Audible's other 100,000 plus titles, can be yours. And all you have to do is go to audibletrial.com/thedrilldown. That's audibletrial.com/thedrilldown for that free audiobook and the 30-day trial to give you a chance to check out their service. And if you don't like the service, you can cancel Audible and you still get to keep the book. And especially if you've never tried the service before, going to audibletrial.com/thedrilldown helps out our own podcast. So please go to that website and try the service out. All right, we're going to take a little break here and listen to some music. And when we return, Microsoft unleashes the new Xbox One. So take a listen to this and come on back.
One is the loneliest number that you'll ever do. Two can be as bad as one. It's the loneliest number since the number one. No is the saddest experience you'll ever know. Yes, it's the saddest experience you'll ever know. Because one is the loneliest number that you'll ever do. One is the loneliest number that you'll ever know. It's just no good anymore since you went. Because one is the loneliest number that you'll ever do. One is the loneliest number that you'll ever know.
If you're just joining us, you're listening to The Drill Down on Geeks of Doom, the roundtable podcast where we take a look at the best in tech and on the web and how it affects us. I'm here with Duane DeFreitas and Tosin Onufwakin. This week, at an event at its Redmond headquarters, Microsoft introduced the Xbox One. The new console features an upgraded Kinect sensor and will be launching around the world, quote, later this year, which we know means in time for Christmas. Microsoft's Don Mattrick took the stage to say that the new Xbox puts you at the center of a new generation of the living room. The new Xbox features 8 gigabytes of RAM, an 8-core CPU, a 500 gigabyte hard drive, a Blu-ray drive, finally, a USB 3.0 connectivity, gigabit Ethernet, and 802.11n Wi-Fi with Wi-Fi Direct. There's both HDMI in and out port, allowing for TV pass-through and the new Xbox Guide. The new Xbox features three operating systems, including one which is a sliced-down version of Windows 8, allowing coders to use the same kernel on Windows Phone, Windows 8, and Xbox games. The Xbox One will not be compatible with Xbox 360 games.
Boo!
Yes. Yes, well, neither is the PlayStation 4, for that matter.
Yeah, but, I mean, with the Xbox, at least, I don't know. When that happened with the first Xbox, the 360,
yeah,
you're like, okay, fine. It was around for a few years. 360 is a bigger deal. It's 7 years of games. And now suddenly,
yeah,
unless there's some sort of like put your UPC, put in your serial number code and download the game for virtualization on the Xbox One,
nope,
online, unless that happens, and I don't think it, nope, it's unclear whether it will or not.
It's not going to.
That's 7 years of now suddenly unsupported,
yep,
stuff. Think about it. If you bought those games, which you have to,
they're still going to be selling the old Xbox 360
sure, they'll
concurrently.
Sell it, but the fact is that Xbox is, it's not going to get any cheaper. It's going to hang out maybe at $200. And it's going to be a, you know, it still suffers from the reliability issues. So if you have an Xbox, I just think it's a waste. And the whole point of the new Xbox is that you only need one box. But because of the way they played this out, you need two.
Yeah. You need one box. They're touting it, and this is interesting because I felt that it was, you know, that we when we saw the launch of the PS4 earlier last month, Sony I think maybe briefly touched upon this, but it wasn't as much of a significant point as Microsoft is making it. Is that they really want this Xbox One to be a set-top box replacement for you. And that,
it's what the Xbox was always designed to be. The reason why it's called Xbox is because it's, the X means it's variable. It does everything. This is your box. This is your thing.
Right. We never really saw that, like, the original Xbox, that really wasn't apparent in the original Xbox. It was only in the Xbox 360 that started to come into play with their Xbox Live offerings, and now I think they've rolled with it. They're playing to their strengths. They know that a lot of people do the set top box replacement with the Xbox 360, and this they're doubling down and going all in on this one, to the extent that you can pass your cable box through HDMI port in and use Xbox's live guide like overlay, Xbox Guide overlay to basically run your cable box through the Xbox. It's voice controlled, so all you have to do is walk into a room and say Xbox on, and then it automatically turns on and responds to what you want to do, play a game or watch TV or listen to music, etc. There's live viewing, and Microsoft demonstrated a way to swap between games, music, and live TV as fast as flipping channels. Also, gesture controls. You can grab items like movies and stretch them to fill the screen or shrink them. Also, a snap mode that allows you to pop a browser or other sidebar app into the window while you're watching a movie or playing a game, which mirrors features found in Windows 8. The new Kinect also, it's an updated Kinect, which I thought this was interesting. The Kinect is so sensitive now that it can actually sense your heartbeat. A little freaky, but I love the technology. I love the advanced technology there, but it's a little scary.
The Kinect has been fantastic in terms of breaking the mold and showing new functionality for the device. And the fact that they've been able to use it to the point where now you'll be able to answer the phone on Skype, which Microsoft purchased a few years ago,
right,
on the Xbox, using the Kinect's cameras to do a very, and I'm bringing it back, I'm bringing them back, a very Star Trek-like communication interface. And then you get the whole Minority Report action with your hands, being able to use that to navigate through your cable box, your Xbox menus, all those things. They're really focused on reinventing this interface. And for a person like me who uses a Logitech Harmony in order to get all my devices all set up and get to them relatively easily and quickly, this whole cable box pass-through thing is enough to make me think about getting cable again. Because one of the reasons I got rid of cable wasn't just the cost. It was the interface was just so awful. For anyone who cares about UX, UI, the interface was just so terrible. And Microsoft has figured that out. It's just amazing that it's only this division of Microsoft that's impressive right now.
Yeah, really. I mean, it's very telling that this is one of the most across the board successful things that Microsoft has done. The Xbox division in general. Did you guys get a chance to see the keynote, the announcement?
Yeah, I watched a good portion of it, it was interesting. I mean, they were definitely specifically targeting the entire do everything entertainment console, or at least entertainment piece, entertainment appliance. Maybe that's a better word.
This is your living room appliance. You need a television set as a monitor, but this does everything else.
They mentioned a few games, and from some of what we witnessed, some of the facial and human qualities are actually pretty amazing and unique. I think we're going to hear more games when it comes to E3, so I think that's going to be a bit of a wait. But
did you notice how little the emphasis was on games as opposed to set-top box usage for this during the announcement?
I mean, that was really smart of them, I think. Because the fact is, it's like a Democrat going to New York if you're running for president. You don't need to go to New York. They're going to vote for you anyway. You know, the gamers are going to buy this. The geeks are going to buy this. You have to appeal to the wider audience. This is your device for your living room. It's going to have good stuff for your children. It's going to have good stuff for, you know, the person who wants to watch whatever. It's going to give you access to your content. It's going to do it all in a way that you really enjoy. It's got space for DVR. It's got all this stuff. It's your Swiss Army knife for the living room. The gamers are already there, so you don't have to pander to them any longer.
And I think the big thing is there are not that many. Although they mentioned that they're going to have, I think it was like 15 new IPs, a lot of games are multi-platform, so you need to differentiate yourself in some other way. And
this is true.
Yeah, exactly.
This is by true. Attacking this from a, you know, controls your entire living room space. Mm-hmm. You know, that's a great way to start selling and start putting together the pieces of this new console. Though, you know, it is for me, literally my Xbox these days is more just my entertainment hub that I use to stream and watch things, be it on Netflix or from my computer via various streaming applications. So, you know, I bet you they have stats of what people are tend to do on their console, and I bet you the entertainment portion of it has grown in leaps and bounds.
And it's been an emphasis. I mean, Xbox has, unlike the PlayStation, in order to get access to the internet, you have to pay the $60 a year. Xbox Live.
Right.
Which means they've got income coming in to make the kinds of content deals that move it. You were able to get ESPN on your Xbox if you had certain cable providers. So I was able to look at college basketball, not the Final Four or anything like that, but throughout the season earlier on, college basketball is what I saw on Saturdays on my Xbox. It was the only reason I turned the thing on.
Yeah, I was able to actually watch early international soccer games that I didn't necessarily have the various
in
ESPN
good quality.
Channels. Yeah, yeah, good streaming.
I'm not saying that it's completely 1080p HD quality, but it's way better than trying to find some ADT HD, whatever that situation is on TV. And it was, you know, it's a good experience. It's easy to navigate. It's native to the controller. It's native. And a controller, in many ways, is actually a better remote than remotes can be. So I don't know. I feel like they did a good job in constantly upgrading the software and spending that money, that wisely earned money, to make it a better, more seamless experience. Whereas on my PlayStation, I do feel a little lost. I like it. You know, I'm not going to not play. I play more games on my PlayStation than my Xbox. But I feel a little lost in terms of the PlayStation Network. And I feel as if the people who are on the PlayStation Network are just there because it's free, not because they want to be or they want to spend resources to. Now, I'm not saying you should have to spend money to get anywhere, but I am saying that it's an interesting thing that kind of like financial barrier makes it so that only people who truly want to be online get online, and they're there for a purpose or purposes. So your that game experience, the online gaming experience, was better. Now that the new Xbox has to be online all the time, is that a subscription thing for everybody? Pricing and availability hasn't really been laid out, so we don't know what the cost is going to be.
What I was actually curious about is how you got what your feelings are on the look and feel of the new console. I mean, I hear that it's larger than the 360, and it's kind of the square block thing.
Yeah, it's very. It looks like a set-top box. It looks like it could be like a Roku or a, any of those set-top boxes. Could sit right alongside your cable box. It doesn't have a distinctive sort of, like the first Xbox or even the 360. It doesn't have those curvy lines. And of course, we don't have anything to compare it to with the PlayStation 4 yet, because they haven't released their actual console.
It looks to me like a 1980s VCR that has been super futurized. So it has that familiar set-top box look. Maybe even one of those a receiver amp kind of look to it.
Uh-huh.
It could just be anything. And what it really is an HTPC. You know, than any other Xbox or PlayStation that's been around. It's an HTPC, and even so much so that it's using Windows. Which the Genesis did, so we'll see how that works out.
I think Sony and Microsoft realized that the technologies that they were using in the previous generation of consoles were a stopgap that could only carry them so far, and now the technology they're using, both systems are using in their machines, are compatible with PC. Desktop computers.
Yeah, I mean, the first Xbox was essentially a computer. The second one was more of a console. But I feel like the thing about it is, after 7 years, the coders on your content making partners, they get so good at optimizing that unchanging technology that the games begin to look better regardless. You know, so I guess what I'm wondering is, are we going to have another long cycle? Is the eighth generation of consoles going to last for another 7 years? Because if it does, I get really excited. If it's a question of trying to be like the way the TV industry is done, say, hey, we're going to have 8K, we're going to have 9K, we're going to have whatever, move quickly, get out of there. It's going to be a little weird. I do also wonder, it has an HDMI out, and that's its main out. What's going to happen with these 8K and 4K television sets?
Right.
If I spend $500, $600, $700 on an Xbox with a terabyte of data of storage on it, 8 gigs of RAM, and I plug it into my new Sony, 4K, 8K TV, is it going to be able to pump that out? I don't think so.
No, I think these both the PS4 and the One are both 2K systems.
Yeah, they're 1920 systems. So I think that it's. It's unfortunate that the timing has happened this way, but maybe not. 4K as a mainstream situation is 2 years, 3 years out, and perhaps there'll be some sort of up-converting technology they'll add to the back of the system.
Sure, sure. As part of the unveiling of Xbox One, the head of 343 Studios, the developer of the Halo series, announced that a brand new live-action Halo TV series is being made. Executive produced by none other than Steven Spielberg. He was one of the names that has been attached to trying to make a movie happen over the years, and the movie hasn't worked out, obviously, despite the fact that
There was a movie.
There was a Forward Unto Dawn series, but it's not an actual,
It got packaged into a movie.
It's not an actual feature release. So it appears that the feature is dead at the moment, and the TV series is the path that they're taking right now. And also, it seems like I gathered from the announcement that this is going to be a Microsoft an Xbox Live exclusive. So you won't,
yeah.
Yeah. Although I'm sure that resourceful minds will make it online, available online one way or the other, even if you're not on Xbox.
Maybe it'll show up on Netflix too. I feel as if, as an entertainment device, they're going to have to take that content and, you know, use it to hook. I mean, Halo's always been a Microsoft exclusive. It was supposed to go to the other consoles, and they were like, no, we need this to buck just what we're doing. And it did a very good job. Halo is wildly successful. Even the Forward Unto Dawn situation was surprisingly interesting to the viewers. They really ate it up. I feel like Halo is the perfect thing to say, this is still an Xbox. That's the pandering, the call out to the gamers.
Yeah.
We're still going to support you when it comes to Halo.
Well, I think they've been lucky that they've gotten so many quality games out of it. Because usually
they put all their resources behind it, is why. Like, that's Halo is the flagship, and they've done a good job of keeping
resources. People who actually care about the game, the new studio definitely put a lot of love into that. So
I remember the first time I played Halo back in, like, I think 2002, and I mean, I'd never played a game on a first person shooter on a console that I actually liked before, and they just got it right. So I'm excited to see what they do with it in this new console, with whatever they're gonna, you know, however they're gonna move forward. You know, whether it's the content that you watch or the content that you play, I'm excited to see what they do with it. And it is a complete new media experience, Halo. Right?
Like, right.
It's only existed in this kind of video game and internet distributed format. So let's
see there. What do you think about the idea that on the Xbox One, as well as I think on the PlayStation 4, that the game content is it's going to be available on disk, but you have to install it to the hard drive in order to play it, and then each game is going to be tied to a unique Xbox Live account. Rather than, so basically you're not going to be able to share your games anymore, or if you are, then the person you share them with is going to have to pay some sort of a licensing fee in order to use that game as well.
I mean, this is a problem for console gamers, I think, because you've been able to, the disc has always been a pretty good way for everybody to be happy.
Yeah.
If you're a publisher, you know that someone needs a disc in order to play. It's very hard to emulate them. Not many people do. If you're a user, you know that you need to buy that disc, and then you can give it to your friend or sell it back later, whatever. They're cutting out the gray market in this, but if you're a PC gamer and you've played any of the recent games, StarCraft, Diablo, The Sims, you know that when you buy that game, that key that comes with that game, that serial number, that's you and only you. It's tied to your account, mm-hmm. and you can't pass that on.
This is true.
So, and that's been that way for years now. 2010 or whatever is when StarCraft 2 came out, right? So maybe 2011. But the idea is that with these connected things, and I'll backtrack. iTunes. When you buy a game on your iPhone or Android, that game purchase is connected to your login, your situation. So as long as I can have a PlayStation at my house in the city and my house in the country, and the login is the same, or, you know, Xbox, whatever, and I don't have to pay to use my disc twice because it's my same login, I don't care. It's when they start charging me for multiple device usage that becomes a problem. Just like with any Blizzard purchase, I can realize I purchased it, and I got a new computer. I can just download it from the Blizzard website. I can just open it up from Steam. I've already paid for it. It's just my account. I'm on the same device. Obviously, I can't use the same exact serial number to play against another version of myself, another login of myself, because both players have to play for it.
That'd be
but
awesome.
I think it's a fair layout. It does change the gray market, the aftermarket stuff.
Right.
I don't think it's going to destroy the way that people buy games. I think people are going to be a little bit more careful about buying games. It's not a question of, I'll just see how it is. If I don't like it, I'll sell it. That's not going to happen anymore.
Nope. Any other things that you want to talk about the Xbox One launch before we...
I don't know if I like the name. I get what they're trying to say. Uh-huh. You only need one device.
Yeah.
But PlayStation has been really serial with their naming scheme.
Sure.
So much so that when the PlayStation 3 came out, the commercial was for the PlayStation 9.
Right.
And we were all like,
I remember that.
Wow. that's going to be the future. Yeah. And it's a weird name, Xbox One.
Yeah.
You know, I get what they're trying to do. I just don't know that I agree with that marketing scheme.
Companies just, these days and their naming policy is kind of...
like
I don't know. They always seem to change it like 8 years down the road.
I don't know, the Galaxy S4 makes a lot of sense to me.
I wasn't too thrilled with the Wii U either because it was just confusing.
The first word is confusing to begin with. We had to figure out how to pronounce Wii when it showed up, right?
Right.
Now Wii U, it's, yeah. But it's Nintendo. The Japanese guys are always a little kooky with their naming conventions and their memory configurations.
I'm glad that they're finally getting on the... I think they couldn't avoid the Blu-ray thing.
Yeah, you guys remember the way that they thought they were going to do it before? Where you got the Xbox, then later on you could buy the...
HD DVD.
DVD drive and attach it in a breakout box, which is so ridiculous. Sony came with the Blu-ray, the PlayStation came with the Blu-ray player for about the same money.
That was the selling point for me for the PlayStation 3.
Yeah. It's like, what am I doing with this HD DVD box? It's a breakout box. It costs $150 on top of everything. And it's not represented by a drive on my computer. It was a mini disc, you know?
Yeah.
Like, the mini disc showed up, and there was no mini disc drive on your computer so you can, like, put music on it or put data on it or whatever. The HD DVD was the same thing. There was no HD DVD writer, you know, that you could just readily buy from Amazon and install on your computer or whatever. So, unlike the Blu-ray system, you know? So, I don't know. I'm pleased that they bowed, even though I don't even know they needed to. To me, the idea that you are going to install a game anyway also says, why not just let me download it if you say my internet connection has to be that big? Now, I get it. It's a lot of data to have to download, a gigabyte, 4 gigabytes, whatever. Mm-hmm. But I, as a PC gamer moved to the consoles, the best thing about PC gaming is not having to think about discs. I installed it. It's there. It's finished. It's done. You know?
We're going to have the entire Xbox One announce video embedded in our show notes. Plus, I think our viral video of the week is going to be this brilliant video that I saw where someone basically compressed the entire launch video into 2 minutes, under 2 minutes. And you get like the essence of what they're trying to say. It's comic, but you get the essence of what the Xbox One, the message that they're trying to sell in this 2 minute video. So that'll be all in the show notes when you go to the geeksofdoom.com. All right, we're going to take another little break here and listen to some music. And when we return, can Tumblr make Yahoo relevant again? Take a listen to this and come on back. Just joining us, you're listening to The Drill Down on Geeks of Doom. I'm Andy Cersini. I'm here with Duane DeFreitas and Tosin Anafawakin. Yahoo confirmed this week that it has acquired popular blogging service Tumblr for about $1.1 billion. Notably, Yahoo CEO Marissa Mayer promises that Yahoo won't ruin the Tumblr experience. We promise not to screw it up, she said in a blog post. Tumblr is incredibly special and has a great thing going. We'll operate Tumblr independently. David Karp will remain CEO. The product roadmap, their team, their wit, their irreverence will all be the same, as will their mission to empower creators to make their best work and get it in front of the audience they deserve. Tumblr is a huge platform for blogging and sharing content. The service hosts 105 million blogs, about 10% of those adult-oriented, and 900 new posts go up per second. It has 300 million monthly unique visitors and 120,000 signups per day. The big weakness for Tumblr is actually making money. It only pulled in $13 million in revenue in 2012, but that's where Yahoo can come in and help the company find more ways to make cash through advertising. Meyer went on to say that the two companies will also work together to create advertising opportunities that are seamless and enhance user experience. Tumblr CEO Karp has previously been vocally resistant to advertising. But yeah, no, forget that. That's just a pipe dream now that Yahoo's on board.
Yeah, well, it's a twofold thing. So
yeah.
2012, eMarketer said that the whole idea in 2012 going into it from 2011 was that it was the year of rich content. It was the year of magnetic content. You have to draw the user into great content if you want to sell them anything. So that's why when you look at YouTube now, the commercials that happen before the videos are good enough for you to want to watch them. They immerse you. Mm-hmm. It's what iAd was supposed to be, but never could be. And I think that what Yahoo has a possibility of doing, what Marissa Mayer could possibly do, is make it so that she works with advertisers and their agencies to put together the kinds of content that rest within Tumblr and enlighten highly targeted, you know, users to products and services that they actually want and use, instead of just kind of like push ads in front of their faces. Tumblr also for Yahoo. If Marissa Mayer is going to go up against her old company, Google,
yeah,
Tumblr is what Blogger can never be. Tumblr is exactly what, like,
yep.
Blogger came out, and I almost feel as though, I don't know the timeline exactly, but Google bought Blogger because Blogger was blown up. But Tumblr, even though I remember back in the day, it was slow, and it was like unbearably slow, and it was all clunky and everything. It's grown really well. It's scaled really well. And it is a more mature and dedicated and easy to navigate space than Blogger ever has been. And I feel like it shows a maturity that Yahoo can take and apply to all of their properties. So if Yahoo's become the content rich company that she wants it to become, Tumblr's a great place to begin disseminating that content.
I thought this was a brilliant move on.
And the money makes sense too.
Yeah.
Instagram, we were like, wait, what?
Yeah.
You know, YouTube, that $1 billion seems to make sense today.
That seems to be the sweet spot nowadays for big acquisitions.
Yeah, I mean, if they had bought it for $300 million, I wouldn't have been shocked either. Right? Like, I wouldn't have been like, oh, that seems so cheap. I think it's a billion is a lot of money, but it makes more sense for Tumblr than so many other properties that have been purchased recently.
Absolutely. I think this was a brilliant move. I think it was an obvious move buying instead of creating relevance from scratch on your own, buying a site that is already highly relevant. But in that, it's also a brilliant move. I mean, I think the rumors had been that there was some rumors that Facebook might beat them to the punch and get this, and I think that Yahoo came in and at the right time and made the right move and paid the right amount of money for.
Yeah, the old Yahoo would have jumped in here and been like, you know what, screw that, I'm gonna go buy GeoCities.
Yeah. Yeah, but I think Tumblr is the right platform. It's the platform, you know, people are shifting away from platforms like Facebook onto sites like Tumblr. And there really isn't any sort of Tumblr equivalent that is as
diverse and dynamic.
Yeah, as dynamic as Tumblr is. There are some reports that some indignant users of Tumblr are migrating to WordPress. But WordPress, but Tumblr existed as an answer to the complexity of WordPress.
Yeah, exactly. Tumblr is great because for anyone who doesn't know, Tumblr is a place where you get to you log in, much like Google's Blogger, and you can create a site. You can use templates. You can use whatever, and all of the actual technology rests in the cloud. You don't have to use plugins. You don't have to do anything. All you need to do is write and tell the computer what kind of post you want to make. I want to post a picture. I want to post some text. I want to post a hyperlink. I just want to, you know, write something down. And it does everything for you. You can even connect it to your own URL. And it's just, it's phenomenal that way. So, yeah, I feel like Tumblr is exactly like it. It's not, it's more than no frills. But it doesn't require the fancy that WordPress does. So people are indignant, and I get it. Yahoo has had a terrible track record with purchasing companies, acquiring companies, and leaving them to die. The fact that it's going to let the old CEO remain in his post, move it forward, and try to use their amazing exchange and advertising technologies to enhance it and monetize the site is a valiant effort, you know?
Mm-hmm.
So we'll see. We'll see.
But do you guys think there's money to be made in Tumblr? Do you think
that remains to be seen? I don't think there's a quick answer for that. There simply isn't a quick answer for that. It's still it's growing so dynamically. It's grown so much in the last 3-4 years, and I think if they do it right and they don't kind of blast you with ads or give you weird Facebook style ads with thumbs up and thumbs down on the side,
right?
There might be room in your Tumblr feed as a Tumblr user to see things that are relevant to you. Not necessarily to put banners up and down and all around or popovers on the actual Tumblr blogs you visit. You see what I'm saying, Tosin, the difference?
Yeah, agreed.
They have to really sort of strategically approach how they're going to deliver that advertising so that it isn't a turn-off to the existing users.
Yeah, and it won't turn off new users. Oh, it's just another site with all these ads on it or whatever. Yeah, it's... This is an interesting purchase, I think. I don't know that we're all crazy excited about Yahoo doing it. Obviously, we're excited about Mercer Mayer's stewardship of Yahoo and turning it around and seeing what you can do. But it's always a little uncomfortable when a service that you like has been acquired by someone else, especially a service that was free to you because you didn't really have the control by paying for it to keep it independent. It's interesting. Academically, it's interesting. Emotionally, it is a little unsettling. When Instagram got bought, I think we were all a little emotionally unsettled.
But fundamentally, nothing has changed about Instagram, at least not so far. In fact, I think it's gotten better because of its integration with Facebook.
I don't know if it's gotten better. I do know that it hasn't had a fundamental change, but I think everybody's waiting for the other penny to drop, other shoe to drop.
Yeah.
To see that. And that's there's anxiety there. There's anxiety when you use Instagram now that wasn't there before.
That's always the case with big acquisitions like this. It's been a big week for Yahoo. They also updated Flickr. It got a huge revamp, including a totally new look and feel, focused on three different things. First, there are no more bits of text or blue links, but rather a grid layout of huge pictures in full resolution. Again, very much like Pinterest. I think Pinterest was a major influence for a lot of these revamps. Second, stemming from the updated iOS app, which yielded 25% more uploads, the company is also announcing a brand new Android experience, catching the Google version of the Flickr app up to the iOS version. And finally, Flickr looks to get bigger. The company is expanding storage for your photos by quite a bit. It's offering a terabyte of free storage for every Flickr user.
If you're a premium user?
If you're a premium user, nothing changes. If you're a premium user, you have unlimited upload. You can upload as much as you want. And if you're a free user, now that limit is 1 terabyte, which is still quite a bit.
I mean, that's fantastic. I look at my iTunes, my iPhoto library at, I don't know, it's maybe 200 gigabytes. So it's not small, but it's not a terabyte. And I've been paying for Flickr for like 5 years. So... Ballypoo on me for not like hanging back
for not waiting for 5 years. what did you guys think of the new redesign, the UI redesign?
It's cute. I mean, I've been using the app mostly, and I've noticed how the app has changed over time. It's been a pretty decent app over time. on iOS, especially on it's on the phone. It hasn't. It wasn't on the iPad. I haven't tried it on the iPad yet. I don't know if they have like.
But I mean, online. You don't. You really don't use online at all, do you? I mean, you don't really.
I've been going for the last like 2 months, with the exception of being at work. You know, sleep for that like 9 hours, 10 hours a day.
You live mobile.
I live mobile. I live iPad. I live iPhone.
He's part of that mobile workforce.
Well, I mean, not that. When I'm working in the workforce, I'm on a desktop computer. I'm on my laptop, and I'm using Chrome, and I'm using Outlook, and I'm using all these situations. But when I'm out of there, I'm not sitting at my desk right now. I need to get away.
Tosin, have you checked out their online version?
I mean, I've looked at their desk version a bit, and the first thing which actually comes to me a lot, and this is me being geeky, is are you guys familiar with Bootstrap?
I know the term, but I don't know if you're referring to a company. I don't know.
So there, I think it was a group of maybe Twitter developers who released a site which basically shows you how to do essential stuff using CSS, as well as provides you kind of a quick and easy way of building elegant websites. I'll provide you guys a link right now so you can take a look at it. But once you start playing around with Bootstrap, you see it all over the place. And that was the first thing that came to mind was, oh, this, at least from their exploration. So I actually don't have a Flickr account.
Uh-huh.
So I was just kind of browsing around and looking at the various collections. And I was just like, yep, they just use Bootstrap. They didn't really... I mean, that's not a bad thing.
They didn't really redevelop the whole thing. They went and got that thing, white-labeled it, and was like, new Flickr.
It's out of a box.
Yeah.
For me, I got a little bothered because, again, stupid picture and money decisions. I just spent money on Everpix. Because I was like, I don't know where Flickr's going. I got to get this Everpix thing. And now I'm like, oh, Flickr's fine, and I'm stuck with Everpix.
I'm already a Flickr. I've been a Flickr subscriber for a while, so
same here. But now I spent the $25 on Flickr, and I spent the $50 on Everpix, and now Flickr's awesome, and I don't want the Everpix anymore. Because
seeing it has actually inspired me to. I just got a new camera, and I'll talk about that camera in a future episode once I've gotten a little bit more familiar with it. But it's inspired me to. Want to upload more photos onto Flickr, which I've been wanting to do, but I just haven't been that motivated to do. But I've got this huge backload of photos to upload to there, which now my ass has been kicked by seeing this new design to do so.
Yeah, I have one of those cards that automatically uploads everything to Flickr.
Yeah,
so I just have to kind of go on there and do some organization. But yeah, man, I mean. I'm happy. Flickr and Yahoo Sports are my two reasons for ever going into Yahoo. And I was going to lose one. I was going to walk away from Flickr forever. And I'm glad that they gave me a reason to stay.
And speaking of other pretty cool Yahoo utilities, if you haven't gotten a chance to use it yet, I definitely highly recommend the iOS app Yahoo Weather. It's really well crafted.
Oh.
Which is funny because the actual iOS weather app is powered by Yahoo.
So definitely check it out. It's really well made.
I will definitely give that a
That's
try.
That's the one where you scroll down and you get all the new stuff on the bottom?
Yeah, you get forecasts, you get lots of details, lots of maps, and it's just – it's elegant.
Anything else before we sign off for the evening?
There was that one quick question you proposed.
Oh, yes. Oh, so definitely. So hang out for after we sign off here, because then we're going to get into some spoilers on Star Trek Into Darkness. Was that the question?
There was that, but there was also Google versus Apple in first.
Oh,
in space.
I'm going to say Google. I'm going to say Google. I have to. Apple is product oriented, product motivated. Google is system oriented, and I think they're the ones that are going to be the most likely to have to sponsor the first space station.
I'm going to say Google as well, because Apple is very slow. It's funny that I'm calling Apple slow, but they're very they take their time in making decisions. and try and make sure everything is perfect and unique, while Google, on the whim of, you know, their owners thinking it's their founders thinking it's a cool thing, will jump on, you know, the next ship to the moon or make pretty unique decisions pretty rapidly.
Yeah, I mean, those are all good arguments. I feel like I don't know. I would say that Google has shown us with the Google Car that they're willing to innovate and build the stuff. Is it going to be sparkly and like, you know, Eva on WALL-E? Maybe not, but it's going to work and it's going to work pretty. It's going to be pretty cool. Apple has shown us that they're very keen on linking up with existing technologies if they can, especially their premier technologies. So we saw the integration of the iPhone with, you know, BMW, Lexus, things like that. In this new sort of like car mode, and we've all heard about the whole iCar, the Volkswagen Apple link up, but it hasn't happened yet. So I think Tosin's right. Apple's slow, but I think there's a chance that Apple could look at a company like Tesla, which is in the same area physically and which has that premier aspect to it, and say, I'm sorry, not Tesla, SpaceX, mm-hmm. owned by the same guy. And say, we want to work with you. We want to invest in you. You know, Apple currently could purchase SpaceX, regardless of their tax issues. And when they want to get into that vertical, they can do it, and they can do it incredibly rapidly. So that said, if there's going to be a company today, in 2013, that would announce anything about space, it would be Google. I agree.
All right, let's go around the table here. I'm going to start with you, Dwayne. Where can we find you online when you're not here on the Drill Down?
Twitter.com/DwayneD, that's Dwayned, gplus.to/DwayneD, and then you can check out everything I do on flavors.me/DwayneD.
Tosin, how about yourself? Where can we find your work online?
You can find me at twitter.com/toast4321. You can find my movie podcast where we recently, soon we'll be publishing our review of Iron Man 3, irswebcast.blogspot.com. And one thing that I'd like to quickly mention, although I haven't updated it in a while, I do have a Tumblr. And that Tumblr is very unique. It's called peopleeatingtoast.tumblr.com.
Oh, nice.
You have people eating you? That's kind of pornographic.
Well, you know.
As for me, if you go to MrBabyMan.com, it redirects to my Tumblr site. So that is my Tumblr account. Also, Facebook.com/MrBabyMan, Twitter.com/MrBabyMan. And as for our show is on Stitcher. You can also reach our show at Facebook.com/TheDrillDown and Twitter.com/TheDrillDown. If you get an idea for a story you think we should be talking about, tweet us or email us at comments@thedrilldown.com. If you've got a viewpoint on any of the stories we've talked about or any issue that pertains to technology, social media, or geek culture, we want to hear your feedback. Send that story to submissions@thedrilldown.com for us to publish on the site. Let us help you reach the targeted tech-savvy market of influencers and outliers that is our wonderful audience by writing to sales@thedrilldown.com for details. And be sure to catch us next week at the same time and location. And that's it for this episode of The Drill Down. Thanks for joining us.
Thanks. Stay tuned for Star Trek Into Darkness. Spoilers.
So here we go. Then let's go right into spoilers. Okay, so like, you know, the big spoiler of the movie is that essentially it's a reboot of Star Trek II: The Wrath of Khan, but it's more like a reimagining.
Battlestar Galactica take on that,
taking into account J.J. Abrams. Multi-universe reboot of the Star Trek franchise in general. It's a reimagining of the Khan tale. And without having seen Star Trek II: The Wrath of Khan, Tosin, it may not seem as relevant to you. So I'm hoping that it worked on its own as a standalone movie on its own. But I really enjoyed some of the ways I posted a tweet about this movie, and what I said essentially in that tweet is the only appropriate way to reboot a classic movie, which some people consider Star Trek: The Wrath of Khan to be a classic film. It's to completely subvert every expectation people had from the previous film. You don't want to rehash, or you don't want to redo. There's no point in redoing the same emotional beats or the same points, you know, the same plot points as the previous
movie. But they did that. That's exactly what they did.
Yeah, but they did it in
Ship
ways that...
safe. Come on, man. Okay. It was a direct scene lifted from it. They redid
it. They redid some lines, but they redid them in unique and different ways. Like, for example, twisting up who goes into the radiation chamber at the end. Who dies. By the way, that was the thing that I was talking about being a bit of a cop-out. In not to give you, now this is spoilers for Star Trek 2, which you haven't seen yet, Tosin.
Oh, it's okay.
But at the end of The Wrath of Khan, Spock dies. He dies. That character dies. End of story. He is dead as a doornail. No reviving. No coming back to life. Credits roll. Spock is dead.
They lean into the idea that the needs of the many outweigh the needs of the few or the one. It's a recurring theme in Star Trek, which Spock brings up at the beginning of the film in The Wrath of Khan 82. And what's strange is that Spock touches on it. He barely scratches it. This is an Abrams problem. He likes to scratch the surface without going any deeper. So it's mentioned. And if you're a Star Trek fan, you're like, oh, yes, okay, right?
Yeah.
I found myself mouthing the word Khan in the very beginning of the movie. That kind of thing. And in this film, that's, you know, mentioned, but it's not delved into. What does that mean?
But then they cop out. They do a cop out by not having Kirk die at the end of that movie. They give him an out by being
the Khan
able,
blood.
Yeah.
The super Lazarus blood.
Which I felt was a little bit of a cop out.
That was more than a cop out. That was terrible. But you knew it was going to happen from the minute.
Yeah. I mean, foreshadowing it didn't help the fact that it was a cop out.
The foundation that they put in front of it. The minute you saw him take out the blood from Khan, even before you put it in the Tribble. Which is another reference to the old show, right? Mm-hmm. The Tribble, that's what I mean by saying you can do best of both worlds even though it's not Next Generation. The Tribble is like, that's just random. It's just a random thing from the old universe. Boom. You know? But yeah, I think it was weak, but you just can't kill Kirk.
See, now, you know what's frustrating about that is I heard Damon Lindelof in a conversation, and he had said that one of the things that really was influential to him about Star Trek: The Wrath of Khan is that they were able to take that risk. They took the characters.
Yes, I've heard that.
The characters were able to they put them in true jeopardy and place them in situations where they could not get out of, and they signed that they signed off on. That was a finality.
Because they didn't know if they were going to make a third movie. They didn't know how well it was going to do. But Star Trek II, The Wrath of Khan, was equivalent to the second Alien movie, Aliens, in terms of blockbuster success. People loved it. The way they did the Reliant versus the Enterprise hadn't really been done before. Like major battleships in space floating.
Right.
You saw that in a big way in I guess, 83 when the Return of the Jedi showed up. But you didn't really see it. You hadn't really seen it before, especially in Star Trek. So
there's an episode of the original series that was very similar to that, where it was kind of like submarines in space, but not quite to the extent of the.
And the tension and the acting. Star Trek II had Montalban, who acted so well. He outacted Kirk. He showed everybody he could actually be a man on a big screen. And Cumberbatch pulled that off well. He was understated.
Yes.
He didn't have to dominate the whole screen to truly dominate the whole screen. We were always wondering what he was going to do. The use of Klingons
weak. I like the new look. I like the new look. I'm not going to lie. I thought, you know, like, you can't just do the old thing. I like the new look. It was a kind of a mix between the Star Trek motion picture and the Next Generation Klingons. But the way they used the Klingons was just kind of, like, messy. Oh, they're just here. They're not the super tough people that we've been led to believe. They're just kind of, like, there. They could have been any species at all, you know? That he even went to the Klingon homeworld was kind of a waste. They could save Klingons for another situation, but fine, whatever. Marcus, Dr. Marcus.
Yeah.
The fact that she snuck aboard with quote-unquote fake credentials, you can't fake your ID today.
Yeah. Well, I mean, she may have been able to do it.
That's bullshit thing. That's another thing that really bothers me. Like,
yeah. There are some definite loopholes. I feel like maybe she was able to do it because of some security exploit due to the fact that she was the the commander's daughter.
Just say it once and I'll be fine, right?
Yeah.
But or like have her be like, oh, you're the commander's daughter. Okay, yeah, come on in. You know, do that kind of thing. But the whole like my name is faked, but I want to use the Marcus name because Marcus is tied to Star Trek IV.
Sure. Right? Well, one of the major complaints that I've heard is that elements in this movie that mirror Star Trek The Wrath of Khan didn't have to be Khan. It didn't have to be Carol Marcus. It was forced. Yeah.
It was forced. Like, I mean, Khan is cool, but the thing about Khan also is that, like, Khan Noonien Singh is an Indian man.
I'm okay with that. I can forgive the whitewashing of the character.
Nah, man, I'm tired of that. In 1982, I get it. Get the exotic Monta Blonde, do it. But in 2013... you can get, and if you need a blonde Indian, I'm sure you can find one too. There are like a billion of them. But you can get an Indian man to play an Indian character. It's not an excuse anymore. It's just not. Like, the last Airbender was the last straw.
I can forgive that slight for the benefit of having Cumberbatch.
Then change the character, like you said.
Well, that's exactly one of the criticisms.
I just think it's wrong to make him Khan and be like, Indian people don't exist in the future except to, like, you know, blow shit up. I don't know. It was messy. It was very messy in that regard. It was lazy. The narrative overall was pretty good. Better than the first one. But I thought the use of Marcus, especially, because Marcus and Kirk, that insinuates that long-term relationship that
sure
led to,
and we'll probably see that in future films
as long, and I mean that's going to be great as long as we don't see more girls with like tails. I mean that really, like, Star Trek has always been able to appeal to youngsters and adults by just being good. I'm going to throw in these girls with tails and I'm going to say shit a whole bunch of times when I don't really need to. The only time shit should have been used is when Scotty says shit and the door opens so you don't really hear it. That was funny, right?
right.
Oh, shit, and the door opens
up. Uh-huh.
Right? That's clever and funny, and you don't need the other stuff. And that's the thing. Like, I think that's what's being taken away from here with the Abrams. And then the Star Trek Coruscant scene.
Just really, really quickly, from the small things I've seen, isn't that a thing about Kirk that he likes people from different species? Like, I think that was also...
He got all the women in the first one. He would always get all the
women.
It's
not about interspecies relationship. It's about the women.
Yeah, it didn't matter. Even the ugly ones. He just got all the women. That was a great scene from In Living Color. You got all of them, even the ugly ones. That was the thing about Kirk, sure. But I think that worked in the 60s in a way that it doesn't work today. And if you're going to adapt it for us today, you don't need to do it like that. Kirk he's sufficiently complex not to just be... a skirt tail chaser, literally a tail chaser in this case.
But that's part of who his character... I mean, that's one of the things that differentiates Picard from Kirk.
But you could
Picard
express that without him having to pop out of covers.
Yeah. You know? Yeah.
You could express that with him, like, being seductive or getting himself almost in trouble or, you know, flirting or whatever.
How many times during the movie did he turn toward a group of ladies and go, "Ladies?" I mean, you could take shots for how many times that happened.
Yeah, I mean, like, in the first one, there was the Orion slave girl, and it was just, like, so... First of all, an Orion slave girl would never be in Starfleet. Just period. They have shit to run. They run Orion slavers. So that's a problem. But, I don't know, the whole idea that it's Kirk's gonna be with, like, he's just gonna jump up out of out of random stuff, and he's going to hop on his starship and fly away like a buckaroo, you know? I just kind of feel like that's not... Even Kirk wasn't that, you know? He had a lot of weight on his head in terms of how to deal with his crew and how to get the most out of them and how to make sure they didn't die. And that was the thing that they expressed here. He did have, like, the responsibility kicked in. Maybe we'll see Chris Pine as a grown-up in the next one. But, yeah, it was a weird characterization. So, I don't know. I felt that was wasteful. And so was the whole, like, I got to use the word shit every ten minutes. Because that takes away from what Star Trek could be.
Yeah.
You know? It's too PG-13. You can make it cooler. And then, like, the whole thing with, like, the big black ship.
Mm-hmm.
Right?
The dreadnought? Like
that was not necessary. The big black ship.
Uh-huh.
I don't know. And then the Coruscant scene.
Which scene are you referring to when you say that?
Attack of the Clones. Anakin is chasing a shape-shifting assassin jumping from one speeder to the next.
Okay, okay.
Right? And this one, you know, Spock and Khan are just jumping from one speeder to the next in San Francisco. It's like, wait, what? Like, I'm going to jump on this. Oh, I'm going to almost miss it. Luckily, we're both super people. You know, Spock is a half Vulcan, so he's got 1.5 times the strength of a human being, and Khan is super and superior in all ways. And I don't know. It was hammy to a Star Trek fan and to a Star Wars fan. You know, let's take the worst part of Star Wars and incorporate it in Star Trek.
I don't even remember that in Attack of the Clones.
Because it's that bad.
Well, because the movies in general, the prequels in general, were that unmemorable. Yeah. Which is why, once again, I'm thankful that Abrams is going to be rebooting that franchise as well.
I don't know. I just don't know. I mean, he is so much better with movies than he was with TV shows. There is that. The movie was a very entertaining experience. I wasn't surprised by anything in it,
mm-hmm.
but it was incredibly entertaining. Even the bad Admiral, you knew that was him. He was Admiral Cartwright in Star Trek VI. That's what he was. You know? He was ready to take out the Klingons. You know? That kind of thing. Colonel West, Admiral Cartwright, whatever you want to call him. If they really want to make me happy, they'll mm-hmm. throw in some actors as random cameos in the next films. Like, you'll see, like, Rene Auberjonois or whatever just kind of, like, walk through a scene.
But don't they also have to be, unless they're just going to be the actors, if you want to shoehorn the characters from their Star Trek incarnations in there, don't they have to be age-appropriate to...
I just want the actors. I don't want the characters.
Ah.
Like, I don't need another Spock showing up, or like the old. I guess, I mean, like, just have like the, you know, Nana Visitor who played Kieran Reese just walk through a scene.
Sure.
Give me that eye candy. Give me that fan service.
That to me is sort of, pandering fan service to me. I don't need that.
I think it's something that doesn't cost a lot but gets you a lot. I mean, Stan Lee shows up in every movie.
Tosin, any thoughts on? On the Into Darkness, any spoilerific thoughts? Plot wise,
it was a little weird for me when Spock decided to talk to other Spock.
No, I felt that scene was completely unnecessary. You could completely
pretty much forced
cut that out, and the
but
the
he story gave would... him like valuable insight. Apparently, like he said, I told you I would never talk whatever, but this is different. So it's clear that he gave him intel that he wouldn't normally give.
But I think Spock could have come to that conclusion on his own.
They could have written that. Yeah. So there was a little fan service there, just so we could see Nimoy, because Nimoy is old. He may not make it to Star Trek number 5.
Here's a question for you guys. Do you think that this is kind of a complex question? I assume there's going to be a next Star Trek movie. Do you think that A, fans will let J.J. Abrams direct a third one? J.J. Abrams will let himself direct a third one? Or the studio will let J.J. Abrams direct a third one?
The idea of a trilogy is something that I think a lot of today's directors are like, I want to make a trilogy of this classic thing. No one did it with Batman. Favreau almost did it with Iron Man, but decided to become a producer. It's going to be one of those two things. He's going to be involved, or else it won't sell.
Well, you know, to be honest, as much as I want to stay in this world that Abrams has created with the reboot. I feel like that movie ended cleanly, and I don't. I feel like I don't need to see a third movie after this. I can be done with this, the series, and be happy, or have it move on to TV in a TV incarnation, maybe with different actors, if the movie actors don't want to be involved
on TV.
That's
the question I have. That's bigger. I think the movie actors might be like they waited 4 years to get to this movie. It's a very different world, right? So, like, I can see the actors, especially, what's Uhura's name? I could see her just being working on different shit by then, you know?
Sure. Kind of, I mean, these are name feature actors.
Chris Pine. I haven't seen him in much else that's useful. But, you know, Quinto and I keep on forgetting Uhura's name, even though I've seen, like, a whole bunch of shit she's in. I've seen
Zoe Saldana.
Yeah, Saldana, right. Those guys just may not be interested.
Right.
I guess the points in the back end and the cost of the third installment, they get a lot of money for showing up for a third film. So that could do it.
Yeah.
It's just, is that third film going to be worth it in terms of audience? Now, isn't the fact that, like, they've got this 5-year mission, which is a callback to the original Star Trek. Is that something that they want to depict over the next 10 years in film? Right, like that might be, like you said, I think that the call for the 5-year mission might very well be the thing that says, okay, it's time to move it back to television now.
We've saved.
The 5-year mission is going to be on TV with a different guy playing Kirk and a different guy playing Spock, or whatever. But Quinto, I heard him on Fresh Air. He loves this role. He really does.
I think it's great. I think he's one of the standout performers in this reboot.
He got a lot of lines. I'd give him that. But I think that when you look at Carl Urban.
Oh, he's great too.
4 lines in the movie. And he just stands out. And just, you just okay, I get it. He makes sense to me.
Quinto and Urban both just crush their roles. I think they really, like,
no,
every.
I just don't think Quinto's Spock is believable as a
really?
Vulcan. He's not a Vulcan. He's too emotional for a Vulcan.
But he's part human. I mean, you remember. You have to remember that.
I get it. But Spock was part human. Always he's part human. And he was never as emotional as Quinto was, especially in the first film. This film, he's gotten it back. There's a little foundation to the way he's acting. He doesn't want to feel. He's doing the suppression thing. Yada, yada, yada. But really, I find that he was better in this film, but he doesn't come across as that Vulcan. You know, there's been years and there's been decades of Vulcan action, and he's kind of like, eh. And then there's the idea that there are no other Vulcans. You know, there's like 10,000 of the whole species left or something. That's a lot of that means he gets to redefine the whole thing just by the way he acts, which is a little weird. There's not like the part of that aspect of the show was that there's a culture that we don't know, but that will be revealed to us over time, not through just this character, but through what the character has to go through. And that's not going to happen in this new incarnation because there are no other Vulcans, really.
Right, since most of Vulcan was blown up.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. Which is weird because if you think about it, there are humans living every which way in this Star Trek universe. They're living on Titan, they're living in here or there. If you were to blow up Earth, it doesn't seem like the humans would be down to 10,000, but I guess Vulcans were just homebodies.
Yeah, I mean, I don't know. I don't know in this particular reboot. I don't know how the Vulcans were distributed, but it's a good question. All right, anything else, or are we tying it up?
I've just decided that I'm not going to be a fan of anything anymore because the minute you get invested, they're like, okay, you're already going to be here. We're going to reboot it for someone else.
But things need to be shaken up every once in a while.
I think that's a cliche.
No, I don't think that I think that's the opposite of the cliche.
You can tell me shaking up is not a
I think
be shaking up every once in a while.
I think
cliche.
The cliche is to keep things the same, to keep to stay traditional with everything. Traditional is boring. You know, why we shake things up, why we change things is so we get a variety, so we see new things in a new way that we haven't seen before.
I think you can get newness without having to destroy the universe that existed before. Like, literally, He literally destroyed
sometimes,
the universe that existed before.
Sometimes you gotta do that. Sometimes you have to.
I don't know that it was necessary in this case.
Well, you. I don't know. That's the good question here is how much of that philosophy is he going to bring to Star Trek? I mean, Star Wars.
Star Wars is such an expanded universe. You don't have to. You can just maintain.
Yeah.
You know, you can maintain. It's starting with new characters,
right.
New story.
Yep.
He's not using the same exact characters, which is part of the problem. If it were a new story with new characters, if it were the Voyager movies or something, I don't know, it wouldn't be as heartening or disheartening as it is today. But it is what it is. I was entertained, even though I was entertained, which is what matters in the end. Mm-hmm. And I got a free copy of the 2009 movie. through buying it like Visa's Signature Select or something like that. So now I get to watch that movie that I don't like often.
All right. Let's wrap it up. Once again, thanks everyone for hanging out for this spoilerific review of Star Trek Into Darkness. And we'll catch you all next week.